already, and welcome back to the Gutowski Files, starring Stephen Gutowski. He is the founder of the Reload.com and the host of the weekly Reload podcast, and he's from Philly. Anyway, some good news and bad news. We record this. Correct. It is Monday, October 16th, 2023, and the Eagles are no longer undefeated. However, to make that go down a little easier, the Phillies are opening up their championship series tonight against the Diamondbacks. So who knows? Who knows how his day will
end
up?
That's correct. I'm switching into Red October mode here. So, the Eagles played on Sunday. That it was yesterday. Today is Monday. We have the NLCS first game at home. I'm probably going, we're recording this today in part, I don't think I told you this, but in part because I'm probably going to go to that second game up in Philly.
Okay.
So I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be expensive, but, I don't need to go on vacation this year. I'll just do this instead.
Yeah. Well, you got to do it at some point. I think John, people who watch the channel or follow John's socials will know that John Correa just not long ago got to take his mom, who's in failing health, to a 49ers game, a preseason game. So that was a lot of fun. Yeah. And I'm going to a Commanders Rams game in LA later this year. Who knows how that'll turn out? But it's
that probably won't be as fun.
But yeah,
okay. Their stadium's cool though.
Yeah, I get to see SoFi, so that'll be a lot of fun. All right, now we've completely turned off all the non-sports people. So moving on, we'll talk about some gun stuff.
We'll transition this into the Supreme Court's gun case.
Yeah,
out what that's going to be.
Which is just as exciting as any baseball game. So what we're talking about this week is something that we've talked about at least in passing before, which is there is a case, I believe it's out of Texas, involving a defendant named Rahimi. It's a domestic violence case. It was the nexus for it. And the gist of the case is basically to have the Supreme Court sort out, this is how I look at it anyway, sort out, hey, can we, what are the processes and what are the rules around someone who is accused of domestic violence, who has a restraining order, as far as their firearms go? And, this stuff now is all, it has to be looked at through a different lens because of Bruin and some other cases. So, Stephen, for those who don't know much about the case, kind of just real briefly walk us through how the case started and why it should matter to other people who own firearms.
Yeah, certainly. So Bruin kind of created a whole slew of new questions. There's really three big important ones, and that's, who can be restricted from owning firearms? How can they be restricted? In what way? Disarmed or required to get a permit or pay a fee or something like that? And then what guns can be restricted? What kind of firearms can be restricted from public use? So obviously things like assault weapons bans and magazine limits would fall into that last category. But this one is obviously a who case. Who can be restricted from owning firearms? And that's where Zachary Rahimi comes in. He's accused of quite a lot of things. He's not a very upstanding member of society, I would say. I don't think anyone on either side has any illusions about that.
Right.
But that's often the case with Supreme Court defendants, especially criminal defendants.
Well, look at Miranda. That's a perfect example. Yeah. He was not a nice person, but, his name is forever famous in law enforcement circles.
Right. And so the questions deal with principles that will apply to everybody, whether or not the named defendant is a good guy. And honestly, this guy, Rahimi, will probably have his gun rights taken away regardless of the outcome of this case, because he's accused of several crimes that he's being prosecuted for right now that would be felonies that would make him a prohibited person.
So, some of those are gun crimes, correct? Some of those are gun crimes, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. He was accused of a number of gun crimes, another number of shootings, drug-related crimes. He pulled out a gun and shot in the air at a Whataburger because his friend's card was declined. That's one of the accusations in the cases.
Should have gone in and out. He wouldn't have that problem. Sorry, bad joke.
There you go. But so that's why actually his home was searched. The case is a result of a search that police did on his home after this other incident, this sort of a spree of crimes that this guy is accused of going on that include like running people off the road, shooting at them, drug deal related shootings. And then obviously the Whataburger incident that all led police to searching this guy's house. And they found a gun, which was also, it's almost comical in some senses. They found a gun, which was apparently in a similar part of the house as the domestic violence restraining order that this guy was subject to, mm-hmm. Which under current law, it's illegal for somebody subject to a domestic violence restraining order to possess firearms. So they kind of found these things right next to each other and they charged him with that and he was convicted. And so he's challenging that conviction. And, you know, he had a domestic violence restraining order issued against him because a judge found that he was dangerous, that he had committed an act of violence against his mother of his child and then threatened somebody else as well with a firearm. I think he shot at them is the facts of the case, the background here. But he wasn't convicted on those crimes. This was part of the finding by a judge in a domestic violence restraining order that he was, you know, that was issued against him.
Right.
And so the question in the case deals with whether this federal law that says people who are subject to these sorts of restraining orders that have to do with domestic violence is constitutional under the Second Amendment. Like, can you actually disarm somebody who's subject to one of these restraining orders? And, you know, this week at the Reload, we had a couple of different takes on this. We've been obviously reporting on this case since it was accepted. And it's actually the oral arguments are going to begin next month in this case. It's moving fairly quickly and we might get a decision in it earlier than normal. Normally the controversial cases that the court delivers come out in June, but this one, you know, we might see it in January or something like that. Depends on how fast it moves. Hard to predict, but
sure.
Regardless, you know, we've looked at a lot of the arguments in the case. We've done pieces on the government's brief, where essentially a lot of their argument boils down to the idea that Rahimi is not a law-abiding person, and therefore, because of the history and tradition of disarming people who aren't considered to be law-abiding, this law that disarms him is constitutional. That's sort of the government's argument. It's obviously a lot more in depth than that, but that's kind of the baseline that they're going with, because the Supreme Court in its previous gun cases has talked a lot about law abiding, that because most of those cases dealt with people who weren't accused of any crimes having their gun rights restricted anyway.
Right.
And so a lot of the court's wording in those cases talks about how law abiding people have a right to self-defense, and, you know, it goes on at length about that. And so the government is sort of picking up on that language and saying, well, Rahimi's not law abiding, right? So, you know, if you look with a broad enough vision at the past and the history that the court considers for whether or not a gun law is constitutional, well, you know, law abiding people have been disarmed in the past, in the founding era, in some ways, you know, people who didn't take loyalty oaths or people like that. A lot of it is loyalty stuff, to be honest, but you know, and that's what they point to and say, well, with this broad view, people who aren't law-abiding can't own a gun. You know, you could take away their firearms. And on the other hand, you've got Rahimi, the defendant, arguing essentially that, you know, that's way too broad of a view.
Well, yeah, I mean,
there really isn't a history of disarming people over, you know, domestic violence accusations in something like a restraining order from historical times.
Yeah, and it just, people will accuse me, I'm sure, of parsing words or splitting hairs or something like that. But you have to consider the language in these things is very important. What does law abiding mean? Excuse me. And you and I talked about this earlier. We talked about it before here on the show, I'm pretty sure. You know, We all generally understand what we mean when we say law abiding. We mean, you know, generally speaking, you follow the law, you pay your taxes, you know, you don't drive excessively fast, you don't, you know, punch people in the face for no reason. But you know, if you get, again, I always say, if you're involved in a critical encounter, for example, and you use a firearm or any weapon for that matter, but especially a firearm, the way you're going to be treated and whether or not you're going to be charged comes down to a lot of factors. But some of those factors are intangibles, like how does the investigating detective or agent feel about people in general having firearms on their person? How does the prosecutor feel about it? How does the prosecutor's boss feel about the Second Amendment. And so when it comes to law abiding, I mean, if you go to Costco and you get past the guy at the door checking your receipt and you get to your cart and realize, oh no, there's a bottle of aspirin at the bottom of my cart that I forgot to pay for, you've committed theft. Every definition of theft, you've committed theft, whether you meant to or not. So are you now not law abiding, even though you ran back inside, you know, and said, hey, I forgot to pay for this? The minute you're going a mile an hour over the speed limit, technically you're breaking the law. So I just think that that's important that we define our terms and be very careful of the kind of language that we use.
Right. And that is one of the points in a number of these amicus briefs, like these the friends of the courts briefs, right? You have the defense and you have the government will put their briefs in the case, and then you'll get lots of briefs from people who aren't directly involved, but or have an interest in the case in some way.
Right.
And so you've actually seen that basic point you just made in two very interesting briefs that were filed in this case that we've talked about at the Reload and you know, gone in depth on. One of them is from the ACLU, which argues, as you just did, that law abiding essentially is much too broad of a scope for the government to be given that kind of power to essentially say anyone they consider to not be law abiding can be barred from owning firearms. Mm-hmm. Which was particularly interesting to see coming from the ACLU, which has traditionally either not been active much in Second Amendment litigation at all, or more recently has kind of has often come out in favor of stricter gun laws,
right?
Regardless of the sort of civil liberties concerns involved. So in this case, they said that the government is asking for too much power, essentially. However, they did say that the law should be upheld under a different standard, which is people are referring to as dangerousness. Mm-hmm. So somebody who is considered to be dangerous to society or to another individual, like somebody, you know, like a domestic abuser, obviously, could be disarmed because of there is a historical analog that is more specific and closer. There are historical analogs or historical tradition of disarming people who are found to be dangerous, who are considered dangerous, either to society at large, like people who don't take oaths, to, you know, the loyalists essentially at the founding era, or Indian tribes, people of that nature, there were laws against selling firearms to Indians at the founding as well. You know, they point to some of these sorts of bans and say that, you know, the government has a point here about these laws, but they're trying to take too much power from this. They're trying to look at it too broadly. And so instead, you should uphold the law, but it should be under this narrower power being able to restrict firearms for people who are found to be dangerous. But in Rahimi's case, he was actually found to be dangerous. Mm-hmm. There was a finding by the judge that he was actually dangerous. It wasn't there because in this law, this federal law, there are two sections that are important. One says that any restraining order that falls under this category of having found a person to be dangerous because they've committed an act of domestic violence, we're issuing a restraining order under that finding. And then there's a second clause in the federal law that says any restraining order that just restricts somebody from committing violence against their domestic partner and then it doesn't need to have any sort of factual finding that the person is dangerous or that they had committed violence before. It just any restraining order that says you can't commit violence against your domestic partner during, you know, the terms of this restraining order counts the same way under federal law. So you have those two different things. Now in Rahimi's case, he had both of them, right? He fit under both of these definitions. But the difference there has become a significant issue in the case at hand. But yeah, the ACLU says the law is fine because it has this finding of dangerousness, and people who were considered to be dangerous to society were disarmed during the founding. That's the ACLU's position. So it's kind of we think the government's being too broad, but you should still uphold the law argument. Interestingly, though, we had David Koppel, who's a Second Amendment scholar, on the podcast this week because he filed an amicus brief that's kind of the other side of that coin. It's a very similar argument in the sense that, you know, he's arguing, in addition to a number of other prominent Second Amendment pro-gun scholars, that dangerousness could be a reason to restrict somebody's firearms access. But the problem is that the law as it stands, really just one word in the law makes it unconstitutional. And that is, between those two clauses, there's an or, mm-hmm. right? It could be either the restraining order that finds the person is actually dangerous or has committed some act of violence, or the other restraining order that just says you can't, kind of just says you can't break the law,
right?
To be practical about it. But he says if that was an end instead of an or, the law may be constitutional. But unlike the ACLU, which argues it is constitutional under this dangerousness standard that's narrower than what the government wants, Koppel argues that it's not constitutional because it's doesn't meet that dangerousness standard. Because you could have somebody who's subject to one of these orders who has never been found to be a danger to anybody.
Right. Yeah, and let's talk about the Cato Institute a little bit more. For those who don't know, the Cato Institute is sort of a libertarian, I guess, think tank, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. And they put out a lot of really interesting stuff over the years. I've been reliably informed by Stephen Gutowski that the Cato Institute is not named after O.J. Simpson's pool house guest, nor is it named after the sidekick of Inspector Clouseau in the old Pink Panther movies. It's something else. But that aside,
a Roman senator, I believe. So it goes a little further back than Pink Panther.
I mean, that's why you're the journalist, sir. And I'm the podcast host, a retired cop. So I think it's important to note a couple things. One is, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the restraining order in the Rahimi case that prohibits him from having firearms is a temporary restraining order, and it's incumbent upon, it's dependent whether his rights are permanently removed under the law depends on a conviction. I think that's important to note. So, for example, if Stephen Gutowski is arrested for something tomorrow, and there's a dangerousness aspect, and a judge says, okay, well, you have to give all your guns to a third party while this is being, adjudicated, and you can't have guns on your person or in your house. Well, that could end up with him being found not guilty or guilty of an offense that doesn't void his Second Amendment rights, and therefore he gets his guns back. Right. That is the case in this case. So really the question is about this window of time in between the arrest and charging and the end of a trial. But I think even though it's a temporary restraining order and a temporary deprivation of that right, it's still important. You still don't want to be the person who's falsely accused of something or whatever, or has a capricious restraining order filed against you. And there's evidently zero or very little due process involved in the decision to temporarily disarm you. And that, depending on who you are and where you live, that could be a big deal. Am I warm?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this is something for one, you do have a little bit of the what, this is mainly a who case, like who can be disarmed or at least have their Second Amendment rights infringed, or who does the Second Amendment protect? Like, for instance, it only protects the people, which means that it doesn't protect people from other countries necessarily, because they're not part of the political body of the United States, which are subject to these rights. But regardless, there's a little bit of a what question in there. What kind of punishment is allowable under the Second Amendment? If Rahimi is part of the people, if he's protected by the Second Amendment, what can you actually do to restrict his gun rights in that case? And this case was sort of a better one for the government because it isn't a total abrogation of somebody's rights forever for their life,
right?
Like a lot of some of these nonviolent felon restrictions, those are lifelong, right? If you're a nonviolent felon, you can't own guns ever again under our current system, the way it works in practice. And so, it's one of those things where You know, it is a lower punishment because it could, you could get your gun rights back after the restraining order goes away. But at the same time, a lot of the questions that have been raised by people filing these briefs are mainly on that who and sort of how as well. Like, the Cato Institute, as you mentioned, their whole brief is just about due process concerns. So they go through and explain how this restraining order doesn't actually provide the level of process that you would expect for a punishment that takes somebody's firearms away, that takes away a fundamental right.
Right.
You know, it'd be sort of like, you know, if you had a court order that said somebody couldn't attend protests or write in a newspaper
or go to church,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or go to church. Right. You would probably need a very high bar of process to get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe it's possible to restrict somebody's First Amendment rights to that point. It's obviously very rare, but you know, for instance, somebody's in jail, they can't attend protests while they're in jail, and so their First Amendment rights are abrogated to some degree. They can do other things. Like, it's most of the time they can still write or whatever. Gag orders get issued, obviously, in cases occasionally, and that has First Amendment implications to it as well. But the complaint from Cato is that as you you know, restrict somebody's rights, as you go further up that list of like what they can't do, that's supposed to be accompanied by higher and higher protections for the individual's rights.
Right.
You know, if it's something like driving a car is not your right. You know, it's not a fundamental right protected by the Bill of Rights.
Correct.
Right. It's and so you can restrict somebody's access to driving. You can suspend their license without having to go to a jury trial and present evidence to beyond a reasonable doubt, right? Like, right. That's, our traffic courts operate on much lower standards because they're dealing with something that, while important, you know, getting around is obviously an important thing for everyone, but not as fundamental as your First Amendment rights, your Second Amendment rights, your Fourth Amendment rights. That's the argument of the Cato Institute. And they're saying that this process for these domestic violence restraining orders doesn't include a lot of the protections you'd expect for something that takes away a fundamental right for someone, even if it is a temporary restriction on that right. You know, so they talk about how, you know, there's no provision to provide somebody with representation if they can't afford it in these proceedings for domestic violence restraining orders. In most states, they don't have that. They don't have a higher level of proof being required, right? Like, you know, it's, I think it's usually like preponderance of the evidence instead of a higher standard, you know, like beyond a reasonable doubt, right, or something along those lines. It doesn't even oftentimes include notifying the person who's subject to the order that if they accept this, if they don't challenge it, that their gun rights are going to be taken away. Because a lot of times, you know, the argument from Cato is that these get issued in things like divorce proceedings, where oftentimes, at least the argument from Cato and some of the other gun rights advocates in this case, is that some judges will issue these pretty easily, and they'll issue dueling restraining orders, so against both parties. And they basically just say, you can't go near the other party. You can't assault them. You can't break the law. It's kind of what some of these lower level restraining orders say. They don't require you to even have a fact finding that somebody is a danger. You know, as we talked about earlier, there's that second provision. That's the big problem for a lot of these gun rights amici, the friends of the court. That's what amici means, by the way.
Is that plural for amicus? Interesting. I thought.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Amici is plural for amicus, and amicus just means friend of the court. They're sort of like, oh, you know, hey, Supreme Court, here's what I think you should do as your friend. Like, they just give you some advice. You know, obviously they become a lot more polarized and politicized than that in real life, but that's what they're supposed to be. And so a lot of the sort of pro-gun Amakai are saying it's that provision, that second provision is just a no-go because it doesn't even require that this person be found to be a danger, but it takes away their Second Amendment right completely, at least temporarily. And, you know, if you're going to do that, if you're going to have a process where you're taking away someone's Second Amendment rights, it has to have this level of protections that we'd expect for that kind of result. Because as the Supreme Court has ruled, the right to keep and bear arms is an individual right that is fundamental. And if you're removing an individual right that's fundamental, you have to have the kind of court process to go along with that, to operate at that level of seriousness. And Cato is essentially saying that the way it works currently isn't up to snuff.
Yeah. And I, you know, you just have to hope there's a lot of big brain, smart people sorting this stuff out, because there, you can look at either side of an argument like this and find a lot of common ground with the people on both sides of it. On one side, you have someone who, Rahimi's not a great example. It's pretty evident that he's not a good person. He's a violent, you know, actor or whatever. But, you know, there are cases of people falsely accused of all sorts of stuff, to include domestic violence. So that's always a possibility. So, it's not a big deal until you're the person accused of something like that. And all of a sudden, you know, without due process, you're deprived of your right to defend yourself. On the other hand, you know, I think most people have had a relation with someone, a cousin, a sister, a brother, a daughter, a parent, who has had a bad, toxic, violent person in their life. And, you know, when that person walks in the room, everyone feels it. You just know this is not a good person. But there's, you know, or they've made veiled threats or whatever, but there's nothing, you know, there's nothing you can do to protect yourself or that loved one from that person. And so, of course, you want there to be some way to make them a little more safe. Now, with all of that said, all of this comes down to whether or not the person in question is gives a crap about your restraining order and is going to follow it or not, right? I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Because there's, you know, probably every month there's at least one video on our main channel of someone who is where they are in defiance of a restraining order, just doing what they want anyway. So with all of that said, Steve,
yeah,
have anything
I mean,
to add
Rahimi
to that?
Was that kind of guy.
Yeah.
Because he had a gun despite this restraining order. You know, it'll be interesting to see where the court comes down on all this, because, you know, you can look at these different arguments and read these different briefs, and I'd encourage people to do that, or at least read our sort of in-depth analysis of them, have a lot of quotes directly from the briefs in there. But, you know, I don't expect that the court is going to go with the more simplistic argument. You know, Rahimi's brief from, you know, his defense lawyers is pretty straightforward in the idea that there just weren't laws that barred people who committed domestic violence from owning guns at the founding. They just didn't exist. And I think that's fair to say. And under the Bruin analysis, you know, that's kind of all you need to say in theory. But I would have a hard time believing that the court is going to go that direction. Like, I just don't think they're going to overturn, really. I mean, you know, obviously this only deals with the restraining order stuff, and there's more concerns about the due process involved there, as the Cato Institute pointed out, and those are all very legitimate points. And you know, it just doesn't seem to me like the court is going to end up in a place where they're saying that domestic abusers have a right to own a gun. You know, it just doesn't, if you look at how they've gone over the years and the laws that they've struck down in regards to firearms, usually they're on the tail end of sort of cultural revolution against those sorts of restrictions, like handgun bans, for instance. You know, when that got struck down in Heller, there were basically two left in the country, and really only in Chicago and DC.
Right.
You know, total ban on handgun ownership that just didn't exist at that point in time. And so the court kind of likes to go after these outliers. Same thing with Bruin, right? I mean, Bruin, it was a little bit broader because there were about 8 states, and they were relatively large states like California, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, that had that style of gun carry law that kind of was very subjective and in practice meant that most people couldn't get a permit.
Right.
you know, but by that point, you'd already seen a huge sea change in how concealed carry was regulated in the United States. It used to be banned almost everywhere. And then by the point that the Supreme Court actually ruled, you didn't even need a permit in most states to conceal carry anymore. And other than those eight states, every other state had adopted some form of at least shall issue permitting, which is much less restrictive than what was struck down. So when you look at domestic violence gun bans, they're far more popular, right? I think the government's brief said there are 48 states that have this sort of restriction, this mm-hmm. domestic violence restraining order, which surprised me because I thought it would be all 50, to be honest with you.
Right.
And they're just very, most people don't think domestic abusers should have firearms. I think that's a fair thing to say. And there's a lot of good legal arguments over the principles involved here, the legal principles. But you know, I think that the court is probably going to end up with something like what the ACLU or David Koppel has argued, where they're, you know, they're going to look at it and find a way to that comports with what they've already written in Bruin, you know, to refine this test a little bit to uphold domestic violence gun restrictions. That's my guess, at least.
Yeah.
Exactly how they do that is going to be interesting to see.
Absolutely. Folks, you heard Stephen mention, look, you can go read Amicus Briefs if you want to. If you're like me and you're not a complete and utter nerd policy wonk and you want to get the important information on those things, anything like that related to firearms is going to be covered over at thereload.com. Thereload.com is Stephen's site, podcast, publication, newsletter, all that rolled into one. I encourage you to go over there and consider getting a membership. Why do you encourage me to get a membership, Mike? Well, I'll answer that question that I just asked myself. And that's because without the membership dues, Stephen can't continue his work. He's got to go back to work at the car wash and he doesn't want to do that. So I need you to go over to thereload.com and consider getting a membership to fund his very, really very important work. And one of the things I love about reading an article with The Reload almost invariably is you open it up, the headline is very to the point and direct, and you get the important information. You don't get a bunch of superfluous nonsense. It's not a 15-page article that should have been a paragraph. It's just what you need to know, and it's laid out in such a way that the layman can understand it. So, and I love that about Stephen and his team over there. Stephen, I would say good luck to the Phillies, but I live in Arizona, so technically I'm supposed to be a Diamondbacks fan. I'm sort of agnostic with baseball. I grew up in the Orioles country before the Nationals were a thing in D.C., so
they really flamed out this year.
Yeah, you know, the Diamondbacks look pretty good. We'll see what happens.
They do.
If you're paying attention at home, folks, you know what I'm about to say next. I'm about to close this show, and I'm about to tell Stephen, as always, you have the last word.
Absolutely.